The Tom Woods Show, episode 802.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you're searching for a gift for that shaver in your life, then check out harrys.com where you can get a holiday shave set that's thoughtful and practical. Heck, I bought one for that weasel Michael Malice, but don't tell him because he hasn't gotten it yet. Take $5 off at harrys.com with coupon code WOODS. Hi everybody, Tom Woods here. Very glad to be talking today to two identical twin brothers, Tim and Joe Broshu, who happen to live on opposite ends of the earth from each other, and who together do the Anarchitecture Podcast, which you can check out at anarchitecturepodcast.com. According to their site, the Anarchitecture Podcast explores the built environment through an anarcho-capitalist lens. Tim Broshu is a registered architect with 13 years' experience. His brother Joe is a mechanical engineer based in Adelaide, South Australia. All right, let's turn now to Tim and Joe. I'm looking at some notes, and we could easily be talking for days on end, and maybe we should do that and split it up into multiple episodes. I listened to an episode of the Anarchitecture Podcast that went into a lot of some of the basic and frankly somewhat mundane sorts of things that human beings do, like getting their garbage picked up, and you went through and tried to explain how these sorts of things could be handled in a non-state environment. Now, you guys are, one of you is an architect, and the other, Joe, how would you describe your line of work? I mean, you're an engineer, but what kind of engineer?
These days, I'd probably call myself some sort of a multidisciplinary engineer. My education was in mechanical, but these days I work a lot with power stations, so I've picked up a bit of electrical along the way as well.
All right. Now, in dealing with other people in your respective professions, do you find that there is an ideological slant that is common to people in your respective fields? Tim, why don't I ask you first?
Yeah, I would say with architects, I actually found an article recently that where somebody had studied this and found that architects were one of the most kind of left-leaning professions out there.
Really?
And I think there are a few reasons for this. One is that just kind of demographics, for whatever reason, a lot of architects and architecture firms are in cities where the demographics tend to lean more kind of Democrat voting. But I think there's also kind of a deeper mindset that architects have where just because of what we do and the way that we look at the world, I think we have a natural sympathy for kind of central planning because, you know, we look at the world and we want to improve it when we try to find ways to make it better. And so I think that the natural instinct for an architect is to look at a city and want to just reorganize the whole thing kind of in their image. So for one thing, I think that that does make them kind of lean more towards statist and possibly leftist type of solutions. But I think that also opens up the possibility for introducing more libertarian thought to them. Because for the same reason, they are kind of forward-looking and sometimes even idealistic and utopian. There have been a lot of famous architects who have put forth utopian visions of the world. And we're not necessarily trying to get to some kind of utopia with the ideas that we're promoting. But I think that architects are receptive to kind of out-of-the-box ideas, and especially ideas about how society can be organized and how that's reflected in the built environment.
And with engineers, I think they're a bit more of a mixed bag politically. For one thing, engineers, their favorite thing to do is to tell you why something won't work. And I think this makes them very good candidates to be libertarians. Now, engineers, of course, like solving problems using kind of complex chains of reasoning. And so I think that they'd be receptive to some of the ideas that we present, especially with Austrian economics and kind of libertarian property rights theory and all that kind of thing. You know, they like to take things apart, find out how they work, and to break them down into kind of the root causes.
All right, now let's talk about where the two of you are. You guys do a podcast together, and yet you live not exactly next door.
Yeah, and so Joe and I are actually twin brothers, but we live about as far apart from each other on the world as you possibly could. I think if you take a globe and put your finger where I live, which is in the Boston area, and where Joe lives in Adelaide, Australia, you could spin the globe on your fingers. And so that creates a challenge for us making the podcast because there's such a big time difference between those between where we live. So the way it typically works is I wake up at, let's say, 6 in the morning, go down into my basement. I'm bleary-eyed. I'm trying to sip on a cup of coffee. My kids are stomping around upstairs, and I can barely think, let alone talk. You know, and I pull up Skype and call Joe, and here comes Joe on the video. He's well-rested. The kids are in bed. You know, nice dim lights. It's 9:30 at night where he is. He's got soft music playing in the background. He's got a heavy pour of red wine in his hand. And
wearing my smoking jacket.
So that's what we're working with when we try to take on each of our podcast episodes.
Well, sounds like fun. Now, you use this term, the built environment, and you talk about why libertarians should be tackling some of these questions related to the built environment. Well, what does that mean?
The built environment is essentially all of the physical structures and infrastructures that we people create in the world around us to make it work the way we want it to. So at the smaller scale of kind of the individual, it's our homes, it's our offices, shops and restaurants and parks, and all those kinds of spaces and facilities that we occupy. We can zoom out from that to the scale of the city, where we start thinking about roads and transit systems, as well as utilities like electrical and wastewater systems. And then beyond that, we can zoom out a little further to broader regions of area, where we look at ideas like urbanization and suburbanization and trying to understand the overall forces that are driving certain types of development in the land.
So let's talk about some specific examples of this, because some of the specific things that you'd be talking about are considered to be puzzles for libertarians to solve because everybody is accustomed to the traditional government solution. And of course, roads is the classic example, but that's not the only one.
Yeah. I mean, one thing with the roads is, we've got the joke about, you know, who will build the roads, which to libertarians is just kind of a throwaway joke, but to everybody else, it's this baffling puzzle, you know, that they think that in an anarchic society, it just wouldn't happen, that everyone would have to be walking from one place to another. And of course, that's pretty ridiculous. So, and I think one way to answer that is to ask back, you know, who do you think might build the roads in such a society? I mean, one thing about that is, you know, the next time that person's sitting in traffic, instead of thinking, you know, why don't they build more public transport? Maybe they can start thinking about, you know, why hasn't supply met demand on this strip of expensive capital infrastructure that I can use for free?
Yes. As soon as you start asking the question that way, you're halfway to the answer.
That's right. So, I mean, that's one thing about these built environment issues is that there's a lot of issues that people are really familiar with. You know, obviously we all experience the built environment every day. And so if you can kind of plant some of these seeds, you can really get people thinking, you know, a bit more creatively than just relying to this default of, you know, the government can provide it through taxes or something like that.
Part of our goal with our podcast is it's kind of twofold. One is to bring these ideas of libertarianism to people like architects who are interested in the development of the built environment. And the other is to get libertarians familiar with what the discussions are that are happening within the development of the built environment. We see this as a way to, you know, a lot of libertarian ideas and theories and discussions are very abstract. We talk about legal systems and insurance companies and all of this stuff. Where when we start talking about the built environment, these are really concrete, tangible things that people can understand viscerally and kind of grab a hold of. And they also tend to be things that are not really politicized. New developments in the built environment often happen at the local level. And, you know, if somebody wants to, it would typically be a city or a local government, wants to, let's say, build a new road somewhere, that's not really a politicized issue. It's not a left or right issue. It's just more of a pragmatic discussion. And if libertarians can be involved in those discussions, then I think that's a good forum for libertarians to start to get their ideas heard and understood by normal people.
All right. Well, hold on a minute. I think of ourselves as being sort of normal people, but I understand what you're saying.
Well, speak for yourself, Tom.
Yeah. All right. So I listened to one of your and architecture podcast episodes, as I say, where you were going through some of these specific examples, and I really liked the way you dealt with it. I thought, okay, this fills a real gap. These guys have thought through a whole lot of possibilities, everything from public parks to garbage collection, all the way down the line to some of these things that, you know, we all know we need, but it's not necessarily obvious how we would get them. So give me a few examples of these sorts of things and show me how you would use libertarian thinking to come up with a good libertarian solution.
Well, I think one example that I think most people would agree is pretty essential is something like sewage treatment. And of course, the way that this is done in most cities and suburban areas is, of course, you've got this centralized system where you've got pipes coming out of your house and making their way towards a common sewage treatment plant somewhere. This is, of course, a pretty good solution because it gets, obviously, the undesirable materials away from your house and treats it in a way that can be, you know, pretty efficiently dealt with in a reasonably environmentally friendly manner. Now, of course, most people assume that this has to be done by some sort of state entity, you know, because they're the ones who can access the various easements under the roads and so forth to lay down all the pipes. And, you know, they've got the money to build a big sewage treatment plant. But that's not necessarily the way it has to happen. I mean, there's no reason that you couldn't have private companies offering the same services, especially if there's some sort of a new development or something like that, where they could come in, run their own pipes, and then, you know, simply charge people fees for using that service. And there's other ways to think about how this might affect the development of the built environment as well, because, you know, there's other technologies for sort of achieving the same results. You know, obviously, people who are in more remote areas might have just a septic system in their own backyard to handle the same problem. And so you could have more competition, I think, if you didn't have this state-owned kind of subsidized system where, you know, it might actually be more efficient for people to have more septic systems that they manage themselves than it is to run all this infrastructure down to some central facility.
Or at least some kind of more decentralized system of waste management.
Yeah, and so I think this sort of thing is how you can get people thinking, you know, into the sort of second order effects of some of these economic decisions and planning decisions that get made. You know, where it's not always obvious that, you know, the centralized solution is the most efficient way to do something. And I think that if you had more kind of free market solutions, then you'd see a lot more of these sort of substitute solutions being proposed.
I remember one of the points you guys made was that a lot of times today, people are inclined to call the police. There's a problem with their neighbor, so they call the police, first thought. And maybe the neighbor finds out who called the police. Maybe the neighbor doesn't find out. But either way, there's awkwardness forever as a result of that. Because now the neighbor either thinks it was you or doesn't know who it is and therefore is suspicious of everybody in the neighborhood. And the point you made was that even though sometimes libertarian cooperative style solutions to problems aren't as quick and simple as convenient as picking up the phone and calling the police, at the same time, they seem to be better for when, you know, when it comes to creating neighborhood cohesiveness and creating trust among neighbors as opposed to mistrust and who the heck ratted me out.
Yeah, I think that when we start to look at, we talked about different scales of the built environment. When you think about the scale of, let's say, a neighborhood, the way that people get along within their neighborhood, by and large, people aren't calling the police to resolve every issue that they have. If there's a problem, hopefully most people will go and talk to their neighbor and try to get it resolved that way. The police are often viewed as, I guess, a last resort. And yet when we start to broaden the scale of people's thinking out to kind of state issues or national issues, everybody just assumes that the state should be the first response, that should be the first place that they go to try to deal with a problem. I mean, that's kind of I think of like the typical format of an NPR story is, you know, here's a problem, here's somebody who's affected by it, and here's what the government says they're going to do about it. And I think that is the way that most people think that problem should be dealt with. But when you start to break that down into the way people actually deal with their neighbors and within their local environment, that's not the way that that's not people's natural instinct for how they want to interact with other people.
You know, the other day I came across on Facebook yet another thread with somebody who thinks that libertarians believe that you ought to try to screw everybody out of their money somehow, and just that, and they believe this is what Ayn Rand wanted, was dishonest people who just look out for themselves. I'm not a huge Ayn Rand fan, but I know she didn't say that. They just look at the title of one of her books and they think they know her entire philosophy. And I was reading, I guess the guy was arguing that libertarians are against communities. They're against, because they think libertarians just don't believe in, I guess, friendship or something. I don't know where this comes from. All we're saying is don't initiate violence. That doesn't mean you can't hang out with friends or go to church or have communities or be in groups or have a family. I mean, none of this follows in any way from any of that. But I sometimes, though, even among libertarians, there are misconceptions. I gave an example the other day. There are libertarians, some of them, who think that tennis is a more libertarian sport than football, because tennis is just one person, unless it's doubles. It's just one person. That has nothing to do with it. As long as you voluntarily join the football team, it's just as libertarian or not as any other sport. Well, likewise, the reason I raise this is that I live in a place in Florida that is planned out. The neighborhood I live in is totally planned. Somebody, a group, planned it. They said, we're going to have houses here, we're going to have lakes and boating and playgrounds and horses and a town square with a market and a doctor's office and a restaurant. We're going to have everything be walkable. We're going to have it nice and flat. We're not going to have any visible telephone poles that make it look hideous. We're just going to have a nice, beautiful, picturesque place. And they planned it out. And there was no government involvement. It was people bought some private land. They planned this out. There's nothing non-libertarian about that. I moved into this planned community, and I am no less libertarian for that. And I noticed that in some of your notes, you also comment on this, that you want to tell libertarians that sometimes planning is okay, and libertarianism does not mean we're against planning. Of course you have to have planning.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, planning is sort of a trigger word for libertarians, I think. You know, they as soon as they hear that, they think there's some sort of, you know, UN Agenda 21 czar who's going to try to, you know, dictate everything they do or whatever. But of course, that's ridiculous. And in reality, you know, there are certainly cases when some level of central planning can work, especially in developing, you know, the layout of a town or something like that. And like you said, in your development, it's a privately owned development, but it exists in a broader kind of anarchic free market, well, relatively anarchic free market, where, like you said, you've got the, it's up to you whether or not you live there or not. You know, you can choose to live there if that's the sort of place that you want to live and the sort of lifestyle that you want to have, or if you want to be living in a more urban area, you know, you can find plenty of places to move there. I mean, I think it is interesting to have a look at the difference between, say, planned cities versus unplanned cities. And especially if you're familiar with the work of someone like Jane Jacobs, you know, she's a real big proponent of sort of unplanned organic development of cities, especially in certain neighborhoods where you get this sort of mixed diversity of uses that really add a lot of character to a small neighborhood block or to a district of a city.
All right, I want to say something about Jane Jacobs also, but first let's thank our sponsor. All right, I'm about to find out if my listeners can keep a secret. I'm going to tell you what I got that weasel Michael Malice, frequent guest here on the show, for Christmas. I got him a Harry's shave set. Now, there are a whole bunch of these shave sets starting at just 15 smackers. They all come with a razor handle, shaving cream, replacement blades, and a travel cover. But the one I got for Malice has all the bells and whistles you can possibly imagine. Plus, I got it engraved with his initials on the razor and the stand. It is a beauty of a gift. And it's, of course, it flatters him having the initials on there, so his ego will really go for that. But it's a beautiful and practical and personalized gift, so I'm getting it for him. And if he finds out about it, I know it's because you guys told him. But if you want to get a great gift for your dad, your brother, some man who shaves, then the Harry's gift sets are perfect for you. Check them out at harrys.com and click on gifts, and you're off to the races. Ground shipping for the holidays ends December 16th, so hurry over to harrys.com and take 5 smackers off your purchase with coupon code WOODS. Let me jump in on Jane Jacobs, because I think the reason that she's been interesting to a lot of our folks is that she's argued that some of these urban planning types have planned cities that don't really work. And that some of the reason that you get a lot of crime is that they've planned cities where there aren't enough eyes on the street. It's not a naturally occurring organic thing. It's a planned thing that seems like it would work to an intellectual, but doesn't actually work for real people.
I mean, I think one way to look at that is if you take this planned city, if you look at it on a map or on a plan, it makes a lot of sense. You know, you can kind of see how everything's laid out. It looks like it's really efficient to get from one place to the next. But what it lacks is the detail that actually occurs at human scale once that's developed. And again, that's something that Jane Jacobs is really big on, is really emphasizing that human scale and looking at how do people actually use those spaces. What are some of the different uses that they come up with? And again, drawing from these uses, you know, what effects does that have on how the city develops and the sort of, I guess you'd call them positive externalities that develop, like you said, eyes on the street, you know, and you do have this community developing as well. And I think, Jane Jacobs, the way she approaches this stuff is very Hayekian. I mean, I don't really know if she was reading Hayek at the time she was writing this, but I think it's actually a way that you can use kind of the ideas of Jane Jacobs to introduce the idea of kind of Hayekian self-organization, even to people like, you know, who would be more left-leaning. I think there's a bit of common ground there between people on the left who like to live in cities, who benefit from these sort of, Greenwich Village style neighborhoods, as well as people who are libertarians who kind of instinctively can appreciate this sort of organic, unplanned development.
One thing that's important to think about there when you talk about planning and the type of community you just described, Tom, there's a difference between planning, kind of setting the guidelines for an area and actually mapping out and drawing the whole thing. So some of those utopian kind of plans, I guess you'd call the modernist plans from the mid-century that Jane Jacobs was reacting to, some of them were very, they took zoning to an extreme. So they would have everybody parceled out into different areas according to what they were doing, whether it was a residential area, a commercial area, even a separate entertainment area, a separate government area. And the idea was that there was this rational organization of society. But as Joe said, that's just not the way that people actually interact. And what really makes cities and streets successful is not necessarily the overall plan, but the individual businesses that pop up within that plan. That's what keeps people coming back. It's not that they want to go and see this grand public space one more time. It's that they want to go and go to that little coffee shop or that food truck that they know they can find there. So again, that it gets back to Jane Jacobs' points about focusing on the individual and the human scale.
So planning per se is not a problem. You can have entrepreneurial planning. But I notice here in some of what you've written, when you're looking over examples of a bunch of planning failures, you've got a number of cases that are related to Boston, which is not surprising given that one of you is from Boston, and I actually grew up in that area. Can you flesh out some examples of failed planning and what the root of the failure was?
Yeah, I mean, when I'm talking about Boston, I think probably most people, especially Bostonians, would agree that one of the biggest kind of urban planning failures in the city is Boston City Hall Plaza. This was an area where they, in the 1960s, it was one of these more organic type of neighborhoods that Jane Jacobs might promote. Although it had fallen into, I guess you'd call it, some blight and disrepair. But the whole neighborhood was raised and taken down to build what is now just a sea of brick, this huge open plaza. And in the middle of it stands this oppressive, brutalist concrete building, which is Boston City Hall. And when you walk in there, it just feels oppressive as you're walking through it. You just imagine all these little bureaucrats kind of peering down at you from six stories above from these little windows. And I think the idea there was that if you built this grand civic space, that, you know, if you built it, that people would come and just want to mill about the halls of government. you know, and be engaging in civic discussions, maybe like the Roman Forum or something. But of course, the reality is that you go there and it's just a wasteland. There's nobody there. The only people you see are the people getting off at the T-stop, walking down the steps down to Quincy Market, which actually is an active space that people use. In fact, the only time I've actually seen City Hall Plaza truly being used was in 2002 when the Patriots had won their first Super Bowl and they had a duck boat parade that ended there and they had a big rally. So apparently that's what it takes to get people to activate the City Hall Plaza is for one of Boston sports teams to win a championship.
Yeah, that's funny. And now that I think about it, of all the time I've spent in Boston, I don't think I've ever been in City Hall Plaza.
Well, you're not missing much.
Yeah, apparently not. Well, I don't feel so bad. All right. You know what? I feel like as long as I have you guys on here, give me an effort to try to help us understand the road question. I mean, I've had people talk about it before, and yet I only feel like 80% satisfied. So what do you say about the roads? Who wants to take that one?
Yeah, I'll jump on that, Tom. This is Joe. I mean, of course, you know, Walter Block's written the book, The Case for Road Privatization, which is probably the Bible on this topic. And actually, I'll admit that I haven't myself read that whole book, but I'm familiar with quite a few of his arguments. But essentially, there's a very similar pattern here to any of these other issues that we discuss, where once you start asking the question of, you know, who should own these roads, you know, who actually is qualified and experienced enough to build them, and how do you make that work? I mean, I think I've heard you say before on your show, it's basically, you know, it's not like someone's going to build a store somewhere and there's going to be all these people living in a house somewhere else and they're just going to be thwarted from from finding each other because there's no roads between them. I mean, obviously they're going to find some way to make that happen. And of course, there's a number of different ways in which this could happen. You know, obviously the store themselves might be interested in building a road out to where, you know, where their customers are. And they might even fund that themselves. You know, and this is a similar concept to something like parking validation, except it's maybe extended out to road validation. And of course, another much kind of simpler and more obvious way is just to have toll roads where people can drive around and maybe you've got a little easy pass sort of thing on your car. And wherever you go, you know, you get pinged on your credit card for the amount of roads that you've used. And there's, of course, different commercial models that you can use to price this sort of thing. So you could have some sort of a, you know, an unlimited subscription service where you've got access to all the roads in a town. Maybe you've got some sort of, you know, you can drive 500 kilometers in a month or something like that. And then if you need more, you can top it up, you know, just like a mobile phone plan. I think one interesting way to approach all this stuff is to think not so much about the technical solutions, but more about the commercial solutions. So really, you're not necessarily thinking, okay, well, how are they going to build a road? I mean, everyone kind of knows how a road is built. What's much more interesting is how are they going to fund that road and keep it viable so that the people who want to use it can keep it running.
Yeah, and beyond the economic case for privatizing roads, one thing that we're actually exploring in the current episode that we're working on is the question of rights to the road. So even if you have a private road, how do we know that they're going to open up that road to everybody who might want to use it? How do you prevent that road owner from kind of clamping down and just restricting people or charging an exorbitant price for people to use the road? And one thing we're exploring is challenging the kind of orthodox anarcho-capitalist idea of property rights. Not that we want to give up property rights by any means, but we're looking at the idea of different uses of land. And in other words, that rather than homesteading a piece of property and that's yours and you have all the rights to that property, that it may make more sense to allow for a legal system that allows for homesteading of uses of the land. So for example, it might be possible for somebody to homestead a piece of land that they're going to turn into a road, or at least they're going to claim ownership of that land. But if it's a piece of land that other people have been traveling over for years and years, I think there could be an argument there that the public use of that land has been homesteaded even while it's owned by a private owner. So it essentially becomes an easement for people to use that land for public use. So this is something that's a bit of a challenge to the I guess what would be Rothbardian, you know, anarcho-capitalism, property rights. But I think that if we're going to communicate with people about how this can work, I think we have to start thinking about different ways in which we allocate property rights that allow for these kind of easements to truly define not just roads or right-of-ways, but even thinking about public space. Public space is a necessary function in any society. And as anarcho-capitalists, I think we want to try to define a way that public space can emerge within an anarchic society.
Let me raise a devil's advocate sort of objection. Would you consider it legitimate, even partly, for somebody to say that you libertarians have a pre-existing ideological desire for, and we're not saying it's bad, but you have this desire to have peaceful interaction, no coercion, and the result of that means that in some of the cases like you're describing, you have to go a very clunky route to get things done, whereas the government could go a much more quick, efficient, crack some skulls, get it done sort of route. Now, I guess my question is, can you make both a natural rights and a utilitarian argument for the libertarian approach, or does it basically boil down to, yeah, it would be probably a lot better to just do the roads by eminent domain and cracking skulls and raising taxes, but our way at least doesn't involve any of that? Or would you say that actually our, not only that, but our roads would be better, or our garbage collection would be better, all these other things would be better? See what I mean?
Yeah, so Tom, it's interesting. There is actually one country in the world where 2/3 of their roads are managed by what they call private road associations. And as you're driving around that country, you'll see all these signs that say private road. Now, it doesn't mean that it's a private road in the sense that the public can't drive on it. What it means is that it's managed by these private road associations. And so I'll give you three guesses as to which anarcho-capitalist utopia this country might be.
I actually don't know.
Well, I think most Bernie Sanders supporters would be shocked to learn that this is Sweden.
Wow.
And so so now I think we've discovered the real reason why Sweden's so great. You know, it's not because they've got socialism, it's because they've got private roads.
Very interesting. Okay.
Yeah. I think, Tom, to give a broader answer to your question, one problem that we face as people who are promoting a more kind of libertarian society, for one thing, we have to define what that society would look like in the end game. But the bigger problem is describing how do we get from here to there? And so that gets you into a process of privatization or divestiture of government assets where, you know, we already have this framework of land ownership and of management of services within the built environment that's really hard to break down. So I think one of the challenges for us is to define how a kind of divestiture process might happen that would allow those things to come into private hands. And again, when we say private hands, that might mean that every taxpayer or every citizen gets some share of ownership of a particular road or a highway or a park. And so I think there's a lot of interesting discussion that can happen there about not just defining what the big picture is for an anarchic society, but also how do you get from here to there?
And that presumably is a good chunk of what you guys are talking about. Tell me about, you've got the podcast, but tell me about how people can actually, other than finding an architecture on the on a podcatcher, how can they follow what you're doing online? You have a website you can tell us about?
Yeah, so our website is anarchitecturepodcast.com. And it's a bit of a mouthful, especially when we're trying to post stuff on Twitter. We've realized that having a long name like that is a bit of a liability. But an easy way to remember it is unarchitecturepodcast.com. So on that website, we've got, of course, the podcast, but we also do some blog posts. We do the occasional silly meme. And then we're also reasonably active on Twitter. You know, we might share some articles on there and do a bit of commentary. So our Twitter handle is anarchitecturep. And of course, you can find that on our webpage as well.
One thing we try to put up on Twitter is finding kind of real world success stories of people who are doing or coming up with the kind of solutions that we're trying to promote on our podcast. So we'll try to find examples of people who are finding ways to develop the built environment where they're not relying on or possibly outright rejecting the typical government approaches. And in fact, one of these, I think, that we tweeted, Tom, was your donor C house that your listeners contributed to build. So we thought that was a great example of individuals taking initiative to make a change that they want to see without relying on government.
Yeah. That episode of my show with Gret Glier, that was one of my favorites, because there's a guy who wanted to make a change and he went out and did it. And then on Twitter, he said, hey, Tom Woodshow listeners, we're going to try and build this widow a house. And within a couple of days, they had raised the money to build a house. Now they've already made a video of people showing us the house and the family walking through and look, showing us the inside of the house. It's unbelievable what's going on. And the idea that we could do that, we could coordinate halfway across the world. We could coordinate the building of a house, donate the resources for that, but we couldn't lay down some tar from your house to a store. Really? You have that little confidence in mankind? Anyway, all right. So anarchitecturepodcast.com is where people should go. I'll have that and your Twitter up at tomwoods.com/802. Thanks, guys. I appreciate what you're doing.
Great. Thanks a lot, Tom.
All right, let's talk about what's coming up tomorrow for episode 803. It's Peter Schiff returning to the show, and I solicited questions from the supporting listeners in my private Facebook group. If you have not yet joined that elite group of wonderful individuals, then become a supporting listener of the show over at supportinglisteners.com. You'll be amazed at all the goodies I give you. It's unbelievable, the stuff I give away if you help me out. So supportinglisteners.com, and you'll be part of the cream of the crop of the human race. What can I tell you? Anyway, that's where I went to try to get some good questions for Peter. So we're going to ask him some questions. So that'll be a lot of fun. I have some other guests lined up that I was inspired to invite thanks to the supporting listeners coming up with, you know, frankly, ideas I wouldn't have thought of. So we got some juicy ones coming up. I'm going to bring Lou Rockwell back again next week by popular demand. So a lot of great stuff coming up. Check out supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.